Let this enemy too be counted among those beasts, since for so long he has been taunting our army and blaspheming our God, who will deliver him into my hands. Saul then, praying that an outcome to match the boy's eagerness and daring might come from God, said, "Go," and sent him out to the battle. He put his own breastplate on him, girded him with his sword, and fitted a helmet on him, and sent him out. But David, weighed down by the armor, for he had not trained or learned to bear arms, said, "O king, let this equipment remain yours for one who is able to carry it. Allow me, as your servant, to fight as I wish." So he set the armor aside, took up his staff, and having gathered 5 stones from the stream and put them in his shepherd's pouch, carrying his sling in his right hand, he advanced against Goliath. The enemy, seeing him coming, despised him for this and mocked him, since he was carrying, not the weapons proper against a man, but rather those with which they drive off dogs and defend themselves. "Does he think I am a dog rather than a man?" David answered that he considered him not merely such, but worse than a dog. This provoked Goliath to anger, and he called curses down on David in the name of his God, and threatened to give his flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth to tear apart. David answered him in turn, "You come against me with sword, spear, and breastplate, but I advance against you armed with God, who will destroy you and your whole army by our hands. For I will cut off your head today and throw the rest of your body to the dogs of your own people, and all will learn that the divine stands as champion of the Hebrews, and that our weapons and our strength lie in his care for us, while all other preparation and power are useless without God's presence." The Philistine, hindered in his speed and stride by the weight of his armor, advanced on foot toward David, contemptuous and confident that he would kill without effort one who was both unarmed and still a boy in age. The young man went to meet him with an ally the enemy could not see, and that was God. Taking from his pouch one of the stones he had gathered from the stream, and fitting it to his sling, he cast it at Goliath's forehead, and the stone struck and passed through to his brain, so that Goliath, instantly stunned, fell forward on his face. David ran up and stood over the fallen enemy, and having no sword of his own, took Goliath's own sword and cut off his head with it. With Goliath's fall, defeat and flight overtook the Philistines. Seeing their champion cast down and fearing for everything, they resolved no longer to hold their ground, but gave themselves over to shameful, disorderly flight and tried to save themselves from the danger. Saul and the whole army of the Hebrews raised a shout and dashed after them, killing many as they pursued them all the way to the borders of Gath and the gates of Ashkelon. About 30,000 of the Philistines died, and twice that number were wounded. Saul, turning back to their camp, plundered and burned their fortifications. David carried Goliath's head to his own tent and dedicated the sword to God. But envy and hatred toward David were stirred up in Saul by the women. For as they went out to meet the victorious army with cymbals and tambourines and every kind of rejoicing, the women sang that Saul had destroyed many thousands of the Philistines, but the young girls sang that David had destroyed tens of thousands. Hearing this, the king reckoned that he himself had received the lesser share of praise, while the greater number, in the tens of thousands, had been credited to the young man, and, concluding that nothing was left for him to lose after such brilliant acclaim except the kingship itself, he began to fear and suspect David. Since it seemed dangerous to have him so near and so close, for he had made him his armor-bearer, Saul removed him from his first post and appointed him instead a commander of 1,000, giving him a position that seemed better but was, as Saul reckoned, safer for himself. For he wished to send him out against the enemy and into battles so that he might be killed amid the dangers. But David, bringing God with him wherever he went, prospered and showed himself successful, so that through the excess of his courage, he won the love of the people and of Saul's daughter, who was still a virgin. And as his passion overpowered her, it became evident and was reported to her father. Saul, taking this as an opportunity for his plot against David, was glad to hear it, and said he would gladly give the girl to him, telling those who reported her love that this would prove the cause of David's ruin and danger for the one who obtained her. "I promise him," he said, "my daughter's hand in marriage, if he brings me 600 heads of our enemies." David, with so splendid a prize now offered, and wishing to win glory by a bold and scarcely credible feat, would set out on the undertaking, Saul reasoned, and would be destroyed by the Philistines, and his affairs would turn out well for him this way, for he would be rid of David through others rather than by killing him himself. So he ordered his servants to sound out David's mind to see how he felt about marrying the girl. They began to speak to him, saying that King Saul and the whole people loved him, and that Saul wished to make him his son-in-law. David said, "Does it seem a small thing to you to become the king's son-in-law? To me it does not seem so, especially since I am a man of low station, without glory or honor." When the servants reported David's answer to Saul, he said, "Tell him it is not money I ask of him, nor a bride price, for in that way one would be selling one's daughter rather than giving her in marriage. But that, since my son-in-law must have courage and every other kind of excellence, which I see he possesses, I wish to receive from him, in place of a bride price for my daughter's hand, not gold or silver, nor anything else brought from his father's house, but rather vengeance on the Philistines and 600 of their heads. For nothing could be a more welcome, more splendid, or more honorable gift to me than this. And for my daughter, it is far more enviable than the customary bride price to live with a man of such quality, one attested by the defeat of our enemies." When these words were brought to David, he was pleased, believing that Saul was eager for the David, delighted that these terms had been reported to him, believing Saul was in earnest about becoming his kinsman, did not wait to deliberate, nor did he stop to weigh in his mind whether the task set before him was possible or difficult. He set out at once with his companions against the enemy, and, for it was God who made everything easy and possible for David, he carried out the exploit promised for the marriage. Killing many and cutting off the heads of 600, he came to the king and displayed them, demanding the marriage in return. Saul, having no way to escape what he had promised, for he thought it shameful either to appear to have lied, or to have promised the marriage as a plot meant to get David killed by attempting the impossible, gave him his daughter, named Michal, in marriage. But Saul was not going to abide long by what had been done. Seeing that David was held in high regard both by God and by the people, he grew afraid and unable to hide his fear over matters so great, his throne and his life, the loss of either being a terrible calamity. He resolved to kill David, and ordered his execution to his son Jonathan and his most trusted servants. Jonathan, astonished that his father's feelings toward David had shifted, not to some moderate coolness out of excessive goodwill, but all the way to a death sentence, and loving the young man and revering his courage, told him his father's secret plan. He advised him, however, to keep out of sight and stay safe the next day. He himself would greet his father, and when the moment arose, speak with him about it, learn the reason, and belittle it, arguing that it was not right to kill, on this account, a man who had done such great good for the people and had been his own benefactor, for which he might reasonably obtain pardon even for the gravest offenses. "I will make known to you my father's mind," he said. David, persuaded by this good advice, kept himself out of the king's sight. The next day Jonathan went to Saul, and finding him cheerful and glad, began to raise the subject of David with him. "What fault, small or great, have you found in him, father, that you have ordered a man put to death, who has been of such great service to your own safety, and greater still for punishing the Philistines, who freed the Hebrew people from the insult and mockery they endured for 40 days, when he alone dared to face the enemy's challenge, and afterward brought back as many heads of the enemy as he was ordered to, and received for this, as his reward, my sister in marriage, so that his death would grieve us not only for his courage, but also for our kinship. For his death would wrong your own daughter as well, since she would be made a widow before she has come to enjoy the benefit of married life. Consider all this and turn to a gentler course, and do no harm to a man who, first, did you a great service by saving you, when he cast out the evil spirit and the demons that had settled upon you and gave your soul peace from them, and second, avenged you on your enemies. It would be shameful to forget these things." Saul was won over by these words and swore to his son that he would do David no harm, for a just argument prevails over anger and fear. Jonathan then sent for David, told him the good and welcome news from his father, and brought him to him, and David remained with the king as before. At this time the Philistines again took the field against the Hebrews, and Saul sent David with an army to fight them. David engaged them, killed many, and returned victorious to the king. But Saul did not receive him as he had hoped after his success. Instead, pained by David's good fortune, he felt himself made the more insecure by David's very achievements. When the evil spirit again came upon him and troubled and disturbed him, he called David into the chamber where he lay, holding his spear, and ordered him to sing to the harp and to hymns. While David was doing as he was told, Saul drew back his arm and hurled the spear. David, seeing it coming, dodged aside, then fled to his own house and stayed there the whole day. That night the king sent men and ordered David watched until dawn, so that he should not entirely slip away and vanish, in order that he might be brought before the court, condemned, and put to death. But Michal, David's wife and the king's daughter, learning her father's intention, stood by her husband, fearful for his prospects and anxious for her own life as well, for she could not bear to go on living if she lost him. "Do not let the sun find you here," she said, "for it will not see you again. Flee while this present night can still give you the chance, and may God make it longer for you. Know that if your father finds you, you are a dead man." She let him down through a window and got him to safety. Then she arranged the bed as though for a sick man, placing a goat's liver under the coverlets. And when at daybreak her father sent for David, she said he had been unwell during the night, showing the covered bed and, by the livers throbbing beneath the covers, giving the impression that the figure lying there was David breathing hard. When those who had been sent reported that he had grown weaker during the night, Saul ordered him brought just as he was, for he meant to kill him. But when they came and uncovered the bed and discovered the woman's trick, they reported it to the king. When her father reproached her for having saved his enemy and outwitted him, she offered a plausible defense. She said he had threatened to kill her, and that out of fear she had helped him escape. For which, she said, it was only right that she be forgiven, since she had acted under compulsion and not by choice. "For I do not think," she said, "that you wanted your enemy dead so much as you wanted me kept safe." And Saul forgave the girl. David, having escaped the danger, went to the prophet Samuel at Ramah and told him of the king's plot against him, and how he had nearly been killed by the spear Saul threw at him, though he had done nothing wrong toward him and had shown no cowardice in the wars against the enemy, but in everything had acted with spirit and success. This was the cause of Saul's hatred for David. When the prophet learned of the king's injustice, he left the city of Ramah and, taking David to a place called Galboth, stayed there with him. When it was reported to Saul that David was with the prophet, he sent soldiers and ordered them to seize him and bring him back. But when they came to Samuel and found an assembly of prophets there, they were seized by the divine spirit and began to prophesy. When Saul heard this, he sent others, and when the same thing happened to them as to the first, he sent still others. And when a third group also began to prophesy, he finally grew angry and set out himself. When he was now close by, Samuel, before Saul could even see him, made him prophesy too. Saul, coming to him, was driven out of his senses by the overwhelming spirit, and stripping off his clothes, fell down and lay there a whole day and night, with Samuel and David looking on. When David came to him from there and lamented his father's plot against him, saying that although he had done no wrong and committed no offense, his father was eager to have him murdered, Jonathan, Saul's son, urged him neither to believe this of his own suspicion nor to trust those who slandered him, if indeed there were such people doing this, but to trust him and take heart. His father intended nothing of the kind against him, for he would have told him about it and taken him into his confidence, as he did in everything else. But David swore that this was indeed so, and asked that, believing him, Jonathan look out for him rather than dismiss his true words as false, only to accept them as true when he either saw him dead or heard of it. He said his father told him nothing of these things, knowing his friendship and disposition toward him. Grieved that, though he had put Saul's intentions to the test, he had not been able to persuade Jonathan, Jonathan asked David what he wanted from him. "I know," David said, "that you are willing to grant and provide me everything. Tomorrow is the new moon, and I am accustomed to dine seated with the king. If you think it best, I will go out of the city and stay hidden in the plain, and when he asks for me, tell him I have gone to my hometown of Bethlehem, since my tribe is keeping a festival there, adding that you gave me leave. If he says what one would expect and usually says of friends away from home, that he has gone off on some good errand, know that there is nothing treacherous or hostile in him. but if he answers in some other way, that will be proof of what has been plotted against me. You will reveal to me my father's mind, showing me this favor out of the pity and friendship for which you have asked pledges from me, and have yourself, as my lord, given them to me. And if you find anything wicked in me, kill me yourself and get to it before my father does." Displeased at this last remark, Jonathan promised to do as David asked, and that if his father gave any grim answer revealing his hostility, he would let him know. And so that David might trust him the more, he took him out into the open air under the clear sky and swore that he would spare nothing for David's safety. "For I call to witness this God," he said, "whom you see everywhere present and poured out over all things, who even before I put my thoughts into words already knew this intention of mine, as witness to our covenant with you, that I will not stop testing my father's intentions again and again, until I learn exactly what they are and gain access to the secrets of his soul. And once I have learned them, I will not conceal them, but will disclose them to you, whether he proves gentle or ill-disposed. This God knows how I pray always that he be with you, for he is with you now and will not leave you, and he will make you stronger than your enemies, whether it is my father or I only remember this. If it should happen that I die, save my children and repay to them the kindness I now show you." Having sworn this, he sent David off to a certain place in the plain he described, where David used to go to train. For, knowing that word would come to him from his father, he said he would bring only a boy with him there. "And when I have shot 3 javelins at the target, I will order the boy to bring me the javelins," he said, "for they will lie in front of him. And if you hear this, know that nothing bad is intended by my father. But if you hear me say the opposite, expect the opposite from the king as well. In any case, you will have safety from me, and nothing untoward will happen to you. But see that you remember these things in your time of good fortune, and be of use to my sons." So David, having received these pledges from Jonathan, went off to the agreed place. The next day, which was the new moon, the king, having purified himself as was his custom, came to the feast, and when his son Jonathan sat at his right and Abner the commander-in-chief on the other side, he saw David's seat empty and kept quiet, supposing that David was absent because he had not purified himself after some contact. But when David was absent on the second day of the new moon as well, he asked his son Jonathan why the son of Jesse had been missing from dinner and the feast both the previous day and this one. Jonathan said that David had gone, as agreed, to his own hometown, since his tribe was keeping a festival with his own permission, and that David had asked Jonathan too to come to the sacrifice, if it were permitted him to go, for you know my goodwill toward him. Then Jonathan recognized his father's hostility toward David and saw clearly the whole of his intention, for Saul did not restrain his anger, but cursing him called him a deserter and an enemy, and said he was David's partner and accomplice, and that he had no shame before him or before his own mother in holding such views, and would not even be persuaded that as long as David lived, their hold on the kingdom remained insecure. "Send for him, then," he said, "so that he may pay the penalty." When Jonathan replied, "What has he done wrong that you want to punish him?" Saul no longer vented his anger in words and curses, but snatched up his spear and sprang at him, meaning to kill him. He did not carry out the deed, being restrained by his friends, but it became plain to his son that he hated David and longed to destroy him, since he had very nearly become his own son's murderer because of him. Then the king's son leapt up from the feast, and unable because of his grief to eat anything, spent the night in tears, mourning both that he himself had nearly been killed and that David had been condemned to die. At daybreak, he went out before the city into the plain, as though to train, but really to reveal to his friend his father's disposition, just as they had agreed. When Jonathan had done as arranged, he sent away the boy who followed him back into the city, and there was quiet for David to come into his presence and speak with him. David appeared and fell at Jonathan's feet, bowing down and calling him the savior of his life. Jonathan raised him up from the ground, and embracing one another, they greeted each other at length, weeping and lamenting their youth and the friendship that had drawn such envy, and the parting soon to come, which seemed to them no different from death. Barely recovering from their mourning and urging each other to remember their oaths, they parted. David then, fleeing the king and the death that threatened him, David came to the city of Nob, to Ahimelech the high priest. Ahimelech was astonished to see him arrive alone, with no friend and no servant accompanying him, and wanted to learn the reason why no one was with him. David told him that he had been ordered by the king to carry out a secret mission, and that for it he could not be attended by any company, since the king wished it kept hidden. "I have instructed my attendants," he said, "to meet me at a certain place." He asked for provisions, since Ahimlech would be doing a friend's work by supplying him and helping him toward the task before him. Having received these, he also asked for some weapon, a sword or a small spear. Now Saul's servant Doeg was present, a Syrian by birth, who tended the king's mules. The high priest said he had nothing of that kind himself, but that Goliath's sword was there, which David, after killing the Philistine, had himself dedicated to God. David took it and fled beyond the territory of the Hebrews to Gath, a city of the Philistines, where Achish was king. But he was recognized by the king's servants and brought to his notice, for they reported that this was David, who had killed many thousands of Philistines. Fearing that he might be put to death by Achish, and that he would meet from him the very danger he had escaped from Saul, David feigned madness and fits, letting foam run down over his mouth, and doing all the other things that would persuade the king of Gath that he suffered from this disease. The king, indignant with his servants for bringing him a lunatic, ordered David thrown out at once. Having gotten safely away from Gath, David came to the tribe of Judah, and while he was staying in the cave near the city of Adullam, he sent to his brothers to let them know where he was. They came to him with their whole family, and all the others who were in need or in fear of King Saul flocked to him as well, declaring themselves ready to do whatever he thought fit. In all, they numbered about 400. Emboldened now that he had gathered a force and men to help him, David set out from there and came to the king of the Moabites and asked him to receive his parents into his own country until he should see how his own affairs would turn out. The king consented to grant the favor and treated David's parents with every honor for as long as they remained with him. The prophet himself then commanded David to leave the wilderness and go settle within the territory allotted to the tribe of Judah. David obeyed, and coming to the city of Herath, remained there. When Saul heard that David had been seen with a large company, he fell into no ordinary confusion and alarm, for knowing the man's spirit and daring, he suspected that no small undertaking would arise from him, one over which he himself would surely have to grieve and suffer. So he called together his friends, his officers, and the tribe from which he himself came, to meet him on the hill where his palace stood. And sitting on a place of honor called Arara, with the customary bodyguard drawn up around him, he said to them, "Men of my own tribe, I know well that you remember my kindnesses to you, that I have made some of you owners of fields, and honored others with rank and with positions among the people. I ask you then, whether you expect greater and more numerous gifts than these from the son of Jesse? For I know that all of you have gone over to him, my own son Jonathan having thought this way himself, and having persuaded you to do the same. I am not unaware of the oaths and the agreements he has made with David, nor that Jonathan is an advisor and accomplice in what has been arranged against me, yet none of you cares about any of this, but you sit in silence watching to see how it will turn out." When the king fell silent, no one else present answered him, but Doeg the Syrian, who tended his mules, said that he had seen David come to the city of Nob, to Ahimlech the high priest, and that Ahimlech had inquired of God on his behalf about the future, given him provisions and Goliath's sword, and sent him off safely to whomever he wished. So Saul sent for the high priest and his whole family, and said, "What have I done to you, that you should receive the son of Jesse, a dreadful and thankless act, give him food and weapons when he was plotting against my kingdom, and consult the future for him besides? For it surely was not hidden from you that he was fleeing from me and hated my house." The high priest did not try to deny what had happened, but openly acknowledged that he had provided these things not as a favor to David, but to Saul himself. He said he had not known the man was Saul's enemy, but rather one of his most trusted servants, a commander of 1,000, and, greater still, already his son-in-law and kinsman. "Such things," he said, "are not given to enemies, but to those held in the highest good will and honor." And it was not the first time he had inquired of God for him. He had done this often before on other occasions as well. "When he told me he had been sent by you in great haste on a mission, I thought it more reasonable to give him what he asked for than to argue with him about it. So do not think ill of me, and do not suspect, because of what you now hear about David's undertaking, that the kindness I showed him then was meant against you. For I gave it to your friend, your son-in-law, your commander, not to your enemy. By saying this, the high priest did not persuade Saul, for fear is a terrible thing, unwilling to trust even a true defense. He ordered the soldiers standing around Ahimelech to kill him. But when they did not dare to lay hands on the high priest, showing more reverence for what was sacred than fear of disobeying the king, he commanded Doeg the Syrian to carry out the killing. Doeg, taking men as wicked as himself, killed Ahimelech and his family, who numbered in all about 385. Saul also sent men to the city of the priests, Nob, and had all its people killed, sparing neither women nor infants nor any other age, and burned the city itself. Only one son of Ahimelech, named Abiathar, escaped alive. All this came about just as God had foretold to the high priest Eli, because of the transgressions of his two sons, saying that his descendants would be destroyed. King Saul, having carried out so brutal a deed, slaughtering an entire family that held the high priesthood, showing no pity for infants and no reverence for the aged, and razing to the ground the very city which the divine had chosen as the home and nurse of priests and prophets, and marked out as the only one destined to produce such men, thereby gave everyone the means of learning and understanding human nature. That as long as men are private citizens of humble station, unable to indulge their nature or dare do all they wish, they are fair-minded and moderate, pursuing only what is just, and show the utmost goodwill and zeal toward it. And at that time, they also believe concerning the divine that it is present at everything that happens in life, and sees not only the deeds that are done, but knows clearly already the very thoughts from which those deeds are going to arise. But once they come into power and authority, then they strip off all of that, and, as if putting away theatrical masks, they cast aside their character and manners and take up instead boldness, recklessness, and contempt for things both human and divine. And it is precisely when, having drawn nearest to being envied and having become conspicuous to all in whatever they think or do, they most need piety and justice, that they behave as though God no longer sees them, or as though he feared their power and so run riot against the world. Whatever they happen to fear on hearing of it, or hate out of some willful impulse, or love without reason, all of this they treat as valid, cert, true, pleasing to men and to God alike, while they give no thought at all to the future. They honor those who have endured great hardships in their service, but having honored them, they envy them, and having raised them to prominence, they strip from them not only that prominence, but on account of it, their very lives as well, on wicked, and through their very extravagance, incredible charges. They punish not those whose deeds deserve justice, but those targeted by slander and untested accusations, not as many as deserve to suffer this, but as many as they are able to kill. This Saul, son of Kish, the first man to reign as king over the Hebrews after the aristocracy and the constitution under the judges, made plain among us, killing 300 priests and prophets out of his suspicion against Ahimelech, and raising along with them the very city and, in a certain sense, the temple itself, striving to leave it empty of priests and prophets, killing so many, and not even allowing their native place to survive, so that others might arise after them. Now Abiathar, Ahimelech's son, the only one of that family of priests slaughtered by Saul able to escape, fled to David and told him of the disaster that had befallen his household and of his father's murder. David said he was not unaware that this would happen to them, for he had seen Doeg there. He had suspected the high priest would be denounced to the king by him, and he blamed himself for their misfortune. He urged Abiathar to stay there and remain with him, since he judged that he would be no safer hidden in any other place. At this time, David heard that the Philistines had invaded the territory of the people of Keilah and were plundering it, and he resolved to march against them, first inquiring of God through the prophet whether he would grant him victory. When the answer came that he would, David set out against the Philistines with his companions, inflicted great slaughter on them, and drove off their plunder. He remained with the men of Keilah until they had safely gathered in their thrashing floors and their crops, but word reached King Saul that he was there among them, for the deed and its success did not stay confined to those in whose midst it happened, but spread everywhere by report, both to the ears of others and to the king's, establishing both the fact and the man who had done it. Saul rejoiced on hearing that David was in Keilah, saying, "God has now delivered him into my hands," since he had forced himself to enter a city with walls, gates, and bars. He ordered the whole army to march against Keilah, besiege it, capture it, and kill David. But David, perceiving this and learning from God that if he remained among them, the men of Keilah would hand him over to Saul, took his 400 men and departed from the city for the wilderness above the place called En-Gedi. When the king heard that David had fled from the men of Keilah, he abandoned his campaign against him. David, moving on from there, came to a place called Horsh, in the district of Ziph, where Jonathan, Saul's son, met with him and, embracing him, urged him to take courage and hold good hopes for the future, and not to grow weary under his present troubles, for he would become king and hold all the power of the Hebrews under himself, though such things are wont to come only with great toil. Once again, they exchanged oaths of goodwill and loyalty toward each other for the whole of their lives, calling God to witness the curses each invoked upon himself, should he break their agreement and turn to the opposite course. Jonathan, having eased David's cares and fears a little, left him there and returned home himself. But the men of Ziph, to curry favor with Saul, informed him that David was staying among them and promised to hand him over if he came against him, since once the narrow passes of the district of Ziph were seized, he would have no way to escape to others. The king praised them, acknowledging his gratitude to them for informing him of his enemy and promising to repay their goodwill before long. He sent men ahead to search for David and scour the wilderness, and answered that he himself would follow. Those sent out on the hunt to capture, David pressed the king forward eagerly, anxious not merely to reveal his enemy's whereabouts out of goodwill toward him, but also to put David more fully within his power by handing him over. Yet they failed in their unjust and wicked desire, men who risked nothing by not disclosing this to Saul, but who, through flattery and hope of profit from the king, betrayed a man beloved of God who was being hunted unjustly to his death, though he could easily have remained hidden and promised to deliver him up. For David, learning of the malice of the Ziphites and of the king's approach, abandoned the narrow passes of their territory and fled to the great rock in the wilderness of Maon. Saul set out in pursuit of him there, for on learning that David had withdrawn from the narrow passes along the road, he made for one side of the rock, while David moved off to the other side. But Saul was turned aside from his pursuit of David, who was on the very point of being captured, when news came that the Philistines had again invaded the territory of the Hebrews. For he judged it more urgent to turn back against them, his natural enemies, and drive them off, than to overlook the ravaging of his land while eagerly bent on catching his personal foe. And so David, having thus escaped danger against all expectation, made his way to the narrow passes of En-Gedi. When Saul had driven out the Philistines, some men came reporting to him that David was staying within the borders of En-Gedi. Taking 3,000 picked men-at-arms, he hastened after him, and coming not far from the place, he saw beside the road a cave, deep and hollow, opening to great length and breadth, where it happened that David, with his 400 men, lay hidden. Pressed by natural need, Saul went into it alone and was seen by one of David's men. When the man who had seen him told his companions that his enemy had, by God's doing, been delivered into his hand for vengeance, and advised him to cut off Saul's head and free himself from all his long wandering and hardship, David rose up and cut off the fringe of the only the piece of the garment Saul was wrapped in, he at once repented, saying it was not right to kill his own master, not even one whom God had deemed worthy of the kingship. For even if this man was wicked toward him, he himself must not be such toward him. When Saul had left the cave, David came out after him and called for Saul to hear him. The king turned around, and David bowed down before him, falling on his face as was the custom, and said, "O king, you ought not lend your ears to wicked men who fabricate false slanders, granting them belief, while holding your dearest friends under suspicion. You ought instead to judge everyone's disposition by their deeds. Slander deceives, but plain proof of goodwill lies in what a man actually does. A word can prove either true or false alike, but deeds lay the mind bare before the eyes. Know then from this that I am well disposed toward you and your house, and that you ought to trust me, and not, by believing my accusers, pursue my life for things I never had in mind, and that could never happen, having no peace day or night, consumed with anxiety over killing me, a pursuit you carry on unjustly? How have you not formed a false opinion of me, as though I wish to kill you? And how are you not impious toward God, in hunting down a man who today had it in his power to punish you and take justice from you, and yet was unwilling, and did not use the opportunity, which, had it fallen to you against me, you would not yourself have let pass, longing to destroy me and counting me an enemy? For when I cut off the edge of your garment, I could at that same moment have taken your head as well. By showing you the piece of cloth, I gave you cause to see and believe. But I, he said, held back from a just act of vengeance, while you feel no shame in nursing an unjust hatred against me. May God judge between us and expose the true character of each. Saul, astounded at the unexpected nature of his deliverance, and struck with wonder at the young man's restraint and character, wept aloud. And when David did the same, Saul answered that it was he himself who had reason to weep. For you, he said, have become the cause of good things for me, and I have misfortunes for you. Today you have shown that you possess the justice of the men of old, who, when they caught their enemies in the wilderness, gave orders to spare them. I am now convinced that God is keeping the kingship for you, and that the might of all the Hebrews awaits you. Give me your sworn word that you will not wipe out my line, nor, bearing me a grudge, destroy my descendants, but that you will preserve and save my house. David swore as Saul asked, and let Saul go back to his own kingdom, while he himself, with the men who were with him, went up into the narrow pass at Maon. At about this time Samuel the prophet also died, a man who enjoyed no ordinary honor among the Hebrews. For the mourning the people carried on for so long a time, and the zeal and eagerness shown in fulfilling the customary rites at his burial, made plain both his virtue and the goodwill the multitude bore him. They buried him in his native city, Ramah, and wept for very many days, not grieving as one grieves for a stranger's death, a thing shared with everyone, but each man mourning him as his own. He was a just man, good by nature, and for that above all beloved by God. He led and stood at the head of the people for 12 years alone after the death of Eli the high priest, and for 18 more alongside Saul the king. And so the story of Samuel came to its end. There was a certain man of the Ziphites, from the town of Emmah, rich and owner of many flocks. He had 3,000 sheep grazing and 1,000 goats. David gave orders to the men with him to keep these flocks unharmed and undamaged, and neither out of desire, nor need, nor the isolation of the wilderness and their ability to do harm unseen, should any of them commit wrong, putting above all these things the rule that no man should be wronged, and holding it a terrible thing, offensive to God, to lay hands on what belonged to others. He taught them this because he believed he was doing a favor to a good man, one worthy of such consideration. Now this man was Nabal, for that was his name, harsh and evil in his ways, having shaped his life on a churlish, dog-like manner, though he had obtained a wife who was good, prudent, and beautiful in appearance. So at the time when Nabal was shearing his sheep, David sent 10 of his men to him, and through them greeted him and wished him well in doing this for many years to come. He asked him to provide, from what he was able, such things as he had learned from the shepherds, that his men had done Nabal no wrong, but had for a long time now, while staying in the wilderness, been guardians of the shepherds and their flocks, and Nabal would have no reason to regret giving something to David. But when those who had been sent delivered this message, Nabal met it with great inhumanity and harshness, for he asked them who David was, and on hearing he was the son of Jesse, said, "So now, it seems, runaway slaves think a great deal of themselves, and pride themselves on having abandoned their masters." When they reported this, David grew angry, and having ordered 400 armed men to follow him, for he now had 600 in all, leaving 200 behind to guard the baggage, he marched against Nabal, having sworn that very night to destroy his house and all his possessions entirely. For he said he was not troubled merely because Nabal had proven ungrateful toward men who had shown him great kindness, giving nothing in return, but because Nabal had also cursed and spoken ill of them, though he had suffered no wrong from them at all. But one of the slaves who guarded Nabal's flocks reported to his mistress, Nabal's wife, that David had sent to him, and that his men had received nothing decent in return, but had even been insulted with terrible curses, though they had used every care and watchfulness in guarding the flocks, and that this had happened to their master's harm. When he said this, Abigail, for that was her name, loaded the donkeys, filled them with gifts of every kind, and without saying a word to her husband, since he was senseless with drink, set out toward David. As she came down through the mountain pass, David met her, coming with the 400 men against Nabal. When the woman saw him, she leaped down, fell on her face, and bowed before him and begged him not to remember Nabal's words. For he was, she said, not unaware that the man matched his name. Nabal in the Hebrew tongue means foolishness, and she excused herself for not having seen the men he had sent. "So forgive me," she said, "and give thanks to God, who has kept you from being stained with human blood. For as long as you remain clean, he himself will take vengeance for you on wicked men. May the evils that await Nabal fall instead upon the heads of your enemies. Be gracious to me, judging me worthy to receive this from you, and let go your rage and your anger against my husband and his house, for my sake. For it befits you to be gentle and kind, especially since you are soon to be king." David, accepting the gifts, said, "But it was God in his mercy, woman, who brought you to us today. For otherwise you would not have lived to see tomorrow, since I had sworn this very night to destroy the house of Nabal, and to leave not one of you alive, from man to beast, since he had proven wicked and ungrateful toward me and my companions. But now you have come before me and softened my anger, God himself caring for you. Yet Nabal, even though he is spared now for your sake, will not escape punishment for his wrongdoing. His own character will destroy him on some other charge." Having said this, he sent the woman away. She went home and found her husband feasting with many guests, already heavy with wine. At that time, she told him nothing of what had happened, but the next day, when he was sober, she told him everything, and the shock of her words and the grief they caused left him paralyzed, his whole body as if dead. And after no more than 10 days he had lived, Nabal died. When David heard of his death, he said it was well that he himself had been avenged by God, for Nabal had died on account of his own wickedness, and paid the penalty while David's own hand remained clean. He recognized then, too, that the wicked are driven on by God, who overlooks nothing among men, but gives to the good what is fitting for the good, and brings swift punishment on the wicked. David then sent to the woman, calling her to come and live with him as his wife. She said to those who came that she was unworthy even to touch his feet, yet she came all the same, with her whole retinue in attendance. And she became his wife, receiving this honor both because his character was prudent and just, and in gaining her, also for her beauty. Now David already had a wife before this, whom he had married from the city of Abesar. And Michal, the daughter of King Saul who had been David's wife, her father had joined in marriage to Phalti, son of Laish, who was from the city of Gethla. After this, some of the Ziphites came and reported to Saul that David was again in their territory, and that they were able to seize him if he wished their help in doing so. Saul marched against him with 3,000 armed men, and when night fell, he made camp in a place called Hakkelah. David, hearing that Saul had come against him, sent scouts and ordered them to find out how far into the region Saul had already advanced. When those at Hakkelah told him, he waited through the night, then, slipping past his own men unseen, made his way into Saul's camp, bringing with him Abishai, the son of his sister Zeruiah, and Abimelech the Hittite. Saul was asleep, with his armed men lying around him in a circle, and his general Abner beside him. David entered the king's camp, but did not kill Saul himself, though he recognized his resting place by the spear that was planted beside him, nor did he allow Abishai, who wanted to kill Saul and had set himself to do it, but said that it was a terrible thing to kill the man whom God had appointed king, wicked though he might be, for in time he would receive justice from the one who had given him his rule. So he held Abishai back from his rush. And as a token that, though able to kill him, he had held back, he took Saul's spear and the flask of water that lay beside him, and, with no one in the camp aware, all of them sound asleep, went out, having done everything fearlessly that the moment and his own daring allowed him to do to the king's men. Crossing the ravine and climbing to the top of the mountain, from where he could be heard clearly, he shouted to Saul's soldiers and to the general Abner, rousing him from sleep and calling out to him and to the people. When the general answered and asked who it was calling him, David said, "I, the son of Jesse, your fugitive. But why is it that you, so great a man and holding the first place of honor beside the king, guard your master's person so carelessly, and find sleep sweeter than his safety and welfare? These things deserve death and punishment, since you did not even notice some of your own men entering the camp a little while ago. Search, then, for the king's spear and the flask of water, and you will learn what harm came upon you unnoticed while it was within your reach." When Saul recognized David's voice and understood that, having had him delivered into his hands by sleep and the carelessness of his guards, David had not killed him but spared him, though he could justly have destroyed him, he said he was grateful to David for his life, and urged him to take courage and, fearing nothing more terrible from him, to return to his own home. For he was now convinced that not even his own son could love him as much as he was loved by David. David, who, though able to protect him and had given many proofs of his goodwill, he had driven away and forced to live so long a time in flight and in anguish for his life, deprived of friends and family, while he himself never ceased being kept safe by him, and never took his life even when it plainly lay within his grasp. David then told him to send someone to retrieve the spear and the flask of water, adding that God would be judge for each of them of his own character and of what he had done in accordance with it, and that God knew that this very day, though able to kill him, David had held back. And Saul, having twice escaped David's hands, returned to his palace and his own household. But David, fearing that if he remained there he might be seized by Saul, judged it better to go up into Philistine territory and stay there. And with the 600 men who were with him, he came to Achish, king of Gath, one of the five cities. The king received him along with his men and gave him a place to live, and having with him also his two wives, Ahinoam and Abigail, he spent his time in Gath. When Saul heard of this, there was no more talk of sending men after him or marching against him, for he had already twice come near to disaster in his eagerness to seize him. But David did not think it right to remain in the city of Gath. Instead, he asked the king, since he had received him so kindly, to grant him this favor too, to give him some place in the country to settle in, since he was ashamed that, by staying in the city, he was a burden and an annoyance to him. Achish gave him a village called Sakela, which David, once he became king, was fond of and honored as his own possession, as did his descendants after him. But of these things we shall speak elsewhere. The length of time David lived in Sakela, in Philistine territory, came to 4 months for 4 months and 20 days. In secret raids on the neighboring Philistine peoples, the Gerzites and the Amalekites, he plundered their territory, taking a great deal of livestock and camels as spoil before turning back. He kept clear of the people themselves, for fear they would report him to King Achish, though he did send Achish a share of the plunder as a gift. When the king asked him whom he had raided to bring back such spoil, David told him it was the people of Judah living toward the south and in the plain, and so persuaded Achish to believe this. Achish, for his part, hoped that David had come to hate his own nation, and that he would keep him as a subject who would remain in his service for life. At that same time, the Philistines resolved to make war on the Israelites, and sent word around to all their allies to join them for the campaign at a place called Regan, from which they meant to muster and march out against the Hebrews. Achish, king of Gath, ordered David to join him in this alliance with his own armed men. David readily agreed, saying that the moment had come for him to repay Achish for his kindness and hospitality, and promised to serve as his bodyguard once the victory and the struggle against the enemy had gone well for them, a pledge by which he only heightened his zeal, through this promise of honor and loyalty. Now Saul, king of the Hebrews, had driven out of the country all diviners, ventriloquists, and every such practitioner of that art, except for the prophets. But when he heard that the Philistines had already arrived and made camp near the city of Shunem, on the plain, he marched out against them with his army. Coming to a mountain called Gilboa, he pitched his camp facing the enemy. He was troubled, not without reason, by the size of the enemy's force, which was thought to be both very large and stronger than his own, and he asked God through the prophets to foretell the outcome of the coming battle. When God gave him no answer, Saul grew still more afraid and lost heart, foreseeing, as was only natural, the disaster that threatened him now that the divine was no longer at his side. He ordered a search made for some woman who was a ventriloquist and could call up the souls of the dead, so that through her he might learn how matters were going to turn out for him. For the ventriloquist's art, by bringing up the souls of the dead, foretells to those who ask what is going to happen. When one of his servants told him there was such a woman in the city of Dor, he slipped away from everyone in the camp, changed out of his royal robes, and taking two servants whom he knew to be utterly loyal, came to the woman at Dor. He asked her to practice her art and bring up for him the soul of whomever he named. The woman refused, saying she would not defy the king, who had banished this class of diviners from the land. She had done Saul no wrong, and it would not be right of him to entrap her into breaking the law so as to punish her for it. Saul swore that no one would learn of it, and that he would not report her divination to anyone else, and that she would come to no harm. Once he had persuaded her with his oaths not to be afraid, he ordered her to bring up the soul of Samuel. Not knowing who Samuel was, she called him up from Hades. When he appeared and the woman saw a dignified, godlike figure, she was seized with fear and, startled at the sight, cried out, "Are you not King Saul?" For Samuel had revealed to her who he was. When Saul nodded that he was and asked her why she was so disturbed, she said she saw someone coming up who looked like a god in form. He told her to describe the figure's appearance and dress and to say how old he was. She answered that he seemed already an old man, of distinguished bearing, wearing a priestly robe. From this, the king recognized that it was Samuel, and, falling to the ground, he did him reverence and bowed down. When Samuel's soul asked why he had disturbed it and forced it to come up, Saul lamented that the enemy pressed hard upon him, that he was at a loss what to do, abandoned as he was by God, receiving no guidance either through prophets or through dreams, and that for this reason he had taken refuge with him, the one who had once watched over him. Samuel, seeing that Saul's fortunes had already reached their end, said, "It is pointless for you to wish to learn anything more from me, now that God has abandoned. But hear this all the same. David must become king and bring the war to a successful end, while you will lose both your kingdom and your life for having disobeyed God and failed to keep his commands in the war against the Amalekites, just as I foretold you while I was still alive. Know, then, that your people will fall into the power of the enemy, and that tomorrow you yourself, together with your sons, will fall in the battle and join me." On hearing this, Saul was struck speechless with grief and collapsed to the ground, whether from the anguish that came upon him at these words or from weakness, for he had eaten nothing the previous day and night and lay there as still as a corpse. When he had barely come to himself, the woman urged him to eat, asking this favor of him in return for the perilous divination she had performed, one it was not lawful for her to carry out, given the danger to herself while not even knowing who he was. Yet she had undertaken it and provided it all the same. In return, she asked him to let her set a table and food before him, so that once he had regained his strength, he might make his way safely back to his own camp. Though he resisted and in his despair had turned entirely away from the thought, she pressed him and won him over. She had a single calf that she kept, one she cared for and fed with her own hands as a poor woman does, her sole comfort and possession. This she slaughtered, prepared the meat, and set it before his servants and before him. So Saul returned to the camp during the night. It is right to commend the woman for her generosity, in that, although she had been forbidden by the king to practice her art, the very king from whom, had things gone otherwise, her household might have had a better and more secure living. And though she had never laid eyes on him before, she bore him no grudge for having condemned her craft, nor did she turn away from him as a stranger with whom she had never had any dealing. Instead, she showed him sympathy, comforted him, and though he was utterly averse to it, urged him toward the very thing that was distasteful to him, and gave him freely and warmly the one thing she had, poor as she was, not repaying some kindness already done to her, nor courting a favor to come, since she knew he was going to die. Most people show generosity either toward those who have already done them some good, or toward those from whom they hope to gain some future advantage. She did neither. It is good, then, to imitate this woman, and to do good to all who are in need, without supposing that anything is more fitting or more proper to the human race, or anything by which we might better secure God's favor as the giver of good things. So much, then, may suffice to have said about the woman. I will now turn to an account that is of value to cities, peoples, and nations, and fitting for good men, one that will move everyone to pursue virtue, to strive for glory, and to leave behind an undying name and memory, and that will instill in kings and rulers of nations alike a great longing and zeal for what is noble, spurring them to face danger and death for their homelands, and teaching them to despise every terror. I take as the occasion for this account Saul, king of the Hebrews. For although he knew what was to happen and the death that awaited him, since the prophet had foretold it, he did not choose to flee it, nor, out of love of life, to abandon his own people to the enemy and disgrace the dignity of his kingship. Instead, he gave himself over, with his whole household and his sons, to danger, judging it a fine thing to fall fighting alongside them for his subjects, and for his sons to die good men rather than be left to an uncertain fate as to what kind of men they would turn out to be. For a worthy heir and lineage will keep his praise and his memory forever undimmed. This man, then, seems to me alone, or if there has ever been or will ever be another like him, just, brave, and self-controlled, and alone worthy to reap from everyone the tribute owed to virtue. Those who go out to war full of hope, expecting to win and to return safe, and who, once they have accomplished some brilliant feat, are then called brave by historians and other writers, I do not think they are rightly so called. Such men are indeed just and deserve approval, but only those who imitate Saul could rightly be called courageous, daring, and men who despise danger. To go into battle without flinching, not knowing what is going to happen, and to leave oneself to the uncertainty of fortune, is not yet a mark of true nobility, even if such men happen to accomplish many great deeds. But to expect nothing good in one's mind, to know beforehand that one must die and suffer this fate in the fighting, and yet not to be afraid or terrified at the danger, but to go forward to meet what one knows lies in store, this, I judge to be the true proof of courage. This, then, is what Saul did, showing that all who long for a good name after death ought to act in such a way as to leave one behind, and above all kings, since the greatness of their power leaves them no room to be anything less than good to their subjects, indeed no room even to be merely moderately good. I could say still more about Saul and his courage, since the subject furnishes ample material, but so as not to appear to make excessive or tasteless use of his praises, I return now to the point from which I turned aside to this digression. The Philistines, then, having encamped, as I said before, and mustering their forces by nation, kingdom, and province, the last king to come forward was Achish with his own army, and David followed with his 600 armed men. When the Philistine commanders saw him, they asked the king where these Hebrews had come from and who had summoned them. He told them that this was David, who had fled from his master Saul and come over to him, and that Achish had received him, and that David now wished to repay the favor and be avenged on Saul by fighting on their side. But the commanders found fault with Achish for having taken on an enemy as an ally, and advised him to send David away, lest he do some great harm to their side without their noticing, for it would give him a way to be reconciled with his former master by damaging their forces. This, they said, was clearly what he had in mind, and they urged that he be sent back, together with his 600 armed men, to the place Achish had given him to live in. For this, they said, was the David of whom the young women sang, that he had destroyed many tens of thousands of Philistines. On hearing this, the king of Gath judged that they had spoken well, and calling David to him said, I myself can testify to your great loyalty and goodwill toward me, and it was for that reason I brought you along as an ally. But the commanders do not share my view. Go, then, at daybreak to the place I gave you, suspecting nothing amiss, and there keep watch over the territory for me, in case any of the enemy should invade it. That, too, is a part of being an ally. So David, as the king of Gath ordered, went to Ziklag. But during the very time he had left to fight alongside the Philistines, the Amalekites had come and taken Ziklag by force, and after burning it and carrying off a great quantity of plunder both from that town and from the rest of the Philistine territory, had withdrawn. David, finding Ziklag sacked, everything plundered, and his own wives, he had too, together with the wives and children of his companions carried off captive, at once tore his clothes. Weeping and mourning with his friends, he was so overcome by these misfortunes that his very tears finally failed him, and he was in danger of being killed, pelted by his own companions, who were in anguish over the captivity of their wives and children, and blamed him for what had happened. But recovering from his grief and turning his mind toward God, he asked the high priest Abiathar to put on the priestly robe, to inquire of God, and to prophesy whether, if he pursued the Amalekites, God would grant him to overtake them, to save the women and children, and to punish the enemy. When the high priest bade him pursue them, David set out at once with his 600 armed men and went after the enemy. Coming to a wadi called Besor, he came upon an Egyptian wandering there, exhausted from want and hunger, for he had gone 3 days lost in the wilderness without food, and, first reviving him with drink and food, asked him who he was and where he came from. The man said he was an Egyptian by birth, left behind by his master, because illness had made him unable to keep up. He told him he had been one of those who had burned and plundered parts of Judea, including Ziklag. David then used him as a guide against the Amalekites, and finding them sprawled on the ground, some eating, others already drunk and slack with wine, enjoying their spoils and plunder, he fell upon them suddenly and slaughtered a great number of them. For, being unarmed and expecting nothing of the kind, but all bent on drinking and feasting, they were easy prey. Some of them were cut down, still reclining at their tables, their blood mingling with the food and drink before them. Others were killed as they toasted one another's health. Others, still as sleep, overcame them from the strong wine. Those who managed to arm themselves in time and stand against him were struck down just as easily as the ones lying unarmed. David's men kept up the slaughter from the first hour until evening, so that no more than 400 of the Amalekites were left, and these escaped by mounting swift camels. He recovered, and everything else the enemy had plundered from them, together with his own wives and those of his companions. When they came back to the place where they had left the 200 men who had been unable to keep up and had stayed with the baggage, the 400 refused to share with them any of the rest of the spoil and plunder, saying that since these men had not joined the pursuit but had grown soft over it, they should be satisfied to get back their rescued wives without receiving anything more. David, however, declared their opinion wicked and unjust. Since God had granted them the power both to punish their enemies and to recover all that was theirs, he said, the spoil should be divided equally among all who had taken part in the campaign, especially since it was by guarding the baggage that these men had remained behind. From that time, this became their established law, that those who guarded the baggage should receive the same share as those who fought. When David reached Ziklag, he sent portions of the spoils to all his acquaintances and friends among the tribe of Judah. Such, then, was the course of the sack of Ziklag and the destruction of the Amalekites. When the Philistines joined battle, a fierce fight followed, and the Philistines won, killing many of their opponents. Saul, king of the Israelites, and his sons fought nobly and with all eagerness, since their entire reputation now rested on dying well and risking everything boldly against the enemy, for they had nothing left beyond this. They turned the whole enemy line upon themselves, and though surrounded, they killed many Philistines before falling. His sons were Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. When they had fallen, the mass of the Hebrews turned to flight, and disorder and confusion arose as the enemy pressed upon them. Saul fled with the strong company he still had around him, but when the Philistines sent javelin throwers and archers after him, he lost all his men but a few. He himself fought brilliantly and received many wounds, until he could no longer hold out or withstand the blows. Unable to kill himself, he ordered his armor-bearer to draw his sword and run him through before the enemy could take him alive. When the armor-bearer did not dare to kill his master, Saul drew his own sword, set it upright, and threw himself upon its point. But he could not stand steady or press the blade through by his own weight, so he turned to a young man standing nearby, and on learning that he was an Amalekite, asked him to press the sword through, since he himself could not manage it with his own hands, and so give him the death he wished. When the young man had done this, he stripped the gold armlet from Saul's arm along with the royal crown and made off. The armor-bearer, seeing Saul dead, killed himself as well. Not one of the king's bodyguard survived. All fell on what is called Mount Gilboa. When the Hebrews living in the valley across the Jordan and those who held the cities on the plain heard that Saul and his sons had fallen and that the force with him had been destroyed, they abandoned their own cities and fled to the strongest fortresses. The Philistines, finding the abandoned cities empty, occupied them. The next day, as the Philistines were stripping the enemy dead, they came upon the bodies of Saul and his sons. They stripped them, cut off their heads, and sent messengers throughout the whole country announcing that their enemies had fallen. They dedicated their armor in the temple of Astarte and impaled their bodies on the walls of the city of Baitshan, which is now called Scythopolis. When the inhabitants of Jabesh, a city of Gilead, heard that Saul's corpse and those of his sons had been mutilated, they thought it terrible to leave them unburied. The bravest and most daring men of the city, for this city produces men strong in body and spirit alike, set out and traveled all through the night to Baitshan. Approaching the enemy's wall, they took down the body of Saul and those of his sons and carried them to Jabesh, without the enemy daring to stop them, out of respect for their courage. The people of Jabesh, weeping as one people, buried the bodies in the finest spot in their territory called Arura, and for 7 days they mourned them, together with their wives and children, beating their breasts and lamenting the king and his sons, tasting neither food nor drink. This was the end Saul met, as Samuel had prophesied, because he had disobeyed God's commands concerning the Amalekites, and because he had destroyed the family of the high priest Ahimelech, Ahimelech himself, and the city of the priests. He reigned 18 years while Samuel was alive, and 22 after his death. Such was the end of Saul's life.